welcome to the Image Doctors. This is episode number 62 for March 20th, 2008. I am Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And welcome back again to where we talk about Nikon and photography in general at the Nikonians podcast. What do we got on tap for this week's episode, Rick?
Well, I think we've got a bunch of things, actually. We're going to start with some listener mail, a couple items that we've received in the last week. And then we're going to spend a fair amount of time on some shooting that we were doing the other day. Ball's one of our favorite landscape locations, Garden of the Gods, and we were trying out some new goodies there, right?
Yeah, especially you.
Well, you were doing some things there too, as I recall.
A little bit.
Yeah, yep. But we're going to talk about infrared shooting and some quick thoughts on the new 24mm tilt shift lens that Nikon just released.
And then hopefully everyone is recovering from a very safe St. Patrick's Day, which was this week. Mm-hmm. And so in the spirit of the Irish, we've brought in my sister, who happens to be living in Ireland these days and visiting. Yep. So we'll have her in the studio in a few minutes
special
to talk about.
Guest star.
That's right. And if you've never, everybody, if you're downloading our podcast, you know my sister already because she's the voice of the Nikonians Talk Radio weekly
news
podcast.
Flash.
The News Flash.
Right.
That's correct. So there's lots of variety of podcasts, and she's been doing the News Flash now for about almost as long as we've been doing this show.
Yeah.
So that'll be good to have her here.
And then you guys went on after the landscape shoot that we did and went up to the Denver Botanical Gardens and did some macro work.
We did, and we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we did macro work in a lot of different ways, and it'll tie into our episode we did a while back on the Cheap Show, because it's good, because we were doing that. And so we'll be talking about our shoots. We'll be answering Jessica's questions. She got to play with the D300 for the first time. So a lot of little things that we can talk about in this episode. And then we'll have our prescription as we always do. But before we get into that and before we get into all the fun stuff, let's go to the mailbag because we've got a couple of
emails.
So this
isn't fun?
This is fun, but this is due diligence. This is because our kind listeners who have had the guts to send an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, we have to back up our promise to read some of these emails on the air and answer these guys' questions. So the first one we got was from Dan Harrod, who lives in London in the UK. And he sent us a nice, very nice email. And the question that he had is planning his summer holiday. He's hoping to be able to visit an island that has a lot of puffins. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to pick our brains on the best way to shoot puffins. And he's got a D80 and a bunch of nice lenses, including the 80-400 VR lens and some teleconverters and all kinds of other goodies. But he wanted to know if we've got anything to do about shooting puffins, because they can be really challenging. Mm-hmm. They're black and white.
Right.
And any black and white animal is a metering nightmare, potentially.
Right. And that's really where the focus of his question was, is what things should he consider regarding metering, especially matrix metering, things of that sort, which is a very valid subject.
That's right. Now, I had an opportunity, actually, visiting my sister when she lived in Maine. We went out to an island, Machias Seal Island, and you can arrange to get a private or semi-private tour to see the puffin colony there. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have good light. Mm-hmm. We had midday light, because that's just, you go out when the tides are and you're at the luck of whatever you get. The boat leaves when the boat leaves. The first thing you want to do with puffins is pray for overcast or partially overcast
light. Yeah. The best thing for birds like that is generally that bright overcast light that we've talked about in the past, right?
Yeah, and that'll help a lot. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you would want to try to do is, can really help with your meter, is get in as close as possible. Because in situations where the black and white bird is dominating the frame, it tends to meter better. Mm-hmm. Where if it's a little speck, if you're using matrix metering, if the bird is fairly small, you'll get a wonderfully metered blue ocean or whatever, and then you'll have clipped black bird and blown white highlights in the same thing. So it's tough.
And the reason why that approach of getting fairly close works is if you can get the blacks and whites fairly equally represented in the frame, then it turns out to be a gray overall. And of course, that's what your meter is really looking for in order to get a good exposure.
So it's not easy, but it can be done. And I was shooting, I think Provia 400 mm-hmm. with my F5. And I got a lot of pictures that, in despite of that light, were quite good. Now, fill flash can help you here, too. Because if nothing else, it can give you just a little bit of catch light in the eye. And usually that's the hard part. Some of these black birds, especially things like, well, what was the other bird that I saw out there? Like MERS and stuff. Mm-hmm. Some of the other, where they have a black eye in a, on a black head. If you can at least get that catch light to pop out,
right,
that can help. And a flash would help you there in balanced fill flash mode with maybe a minus one and two thirds or minus one and a third stop of flash exposure compensation.
Yeah. Now, a lot of times where you'll find puffins, because I've photographed them too. In my case, it was up in Alaska. But a lot of times you'll find them on rock outcroppings mm-hmm. that are fairly dark. And that can just exacerbate the problem because these are rocks that are usually darker than a mid-tone. So what will happen is your meter will want to turn them into a mid-tone subject, which mm-hmm. means, you know, add a little bit more exposure than is appropriate. And then those white sections of the puffins get blown out because you're just shooting with too light of exposure. And what I find pretty helpful in those situations, if you're using matrix metering and you're using auto exposure, is to dial in about minus two-thirds of a stop of exposure compensation. If you've got those birds on dark rocks and you're not filling up the frame with the actual bird. And that usually turns out just about right. The rocks look right, the white areas aren't blown out, and it works out pretty well. And you don't have to worry about, you know, changing your exposure all the time like you would with manual exposure if the sun is coming in and out of clouds.
Yep. So, but the best thing you can do is hope for overcast day. Mm-hmm. That's if
but
you
even
get lucky.
Then, you'll want to consider doing the mm-hmm. trick I was just mentioning.
Okay, so I think hopefully, Dan, thanks for the email, and hopefully that answered your question.
And have fun photographing the puffins.
It will be jealous.
They're great subjects.
Yeah, they're very cool.
Yeah.
We also got a quick email from Joe Travis, and Joe asked us about some questions about the autofocus calibration that we talked about in the last episode, mm-hmm. and he wanted to know what autofocus setting we were using, continuous versus single shot, and whether it made any difference. Because there are a lot of choices on the autofocus systems on these D300s and D3s. Mm-hmm. And what I used was always single area, mm-hmm. single point area autofocus, and I used the center focus point. And I just left mine in the same way I've always autofocused, which is continuous autofocus using the AF on button.
Yeah, which is kind of a hybrid thing because mm-hmm. you'll focus and release typically, which means the focus is locked
right.
and not moving around.
In theory, you shouldn't have any difference between the two modes.
Right.
As long as you're not holding your finger on the autofocus button after it acquires the lock. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's going to be a big deal.
One thing I would suggest though is if for some reason you're keeping it on continuous, and maybe you're using the shutter release to trigger autofocus, and you find that, you know, holding it down that halfway position, you can hear the focusing motor continue.
Oh, the jittering noise.
Yeah, that's an indicator that it's not really locked well. You might have a bad autofocus target, all those kind of things. So something's going wrong if you're not finding it locked on a certain focus setting.
Right, and even in continuous servo, if it locks, it'll stop. You'll notice that it won't do anything else. You can push the AF on button again and nothing will happen. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's locked in. So again, thanks, Joe, for that question. Hopefully we've answered mm-hmm. your question. Now, Joe also had a nice suggestion if for those people who are looking for a focus target. And he found a relatively inexpensive photo target from Edmund Optical, which you can go online. It's www.edmundoptics.com. That's EDMUNDOPTICS.com. He says about $20 US, and he gets a 24 by 36 inch target, which is pretty nice. And then he mounted on a foam core, which mm-hmm. you'll want to do. You want to make something that it's rigid and flat. And he actually went and framed it without glass, but I don't know if you'd, I think with a piece of foam core board, you could probably get away without framing it. Just depends on what you want to do. And he says it's a great consistent target and it mm-hmm. goes all the way out to the edges of the frame. So for people looking for something fancier than that stock page from the newspaper, there's a $20 focus target you can mm-hmm. grab. So that's cool. And you can also do funny resolution things with it too, if you wanted to, I think, but I'll have to go and check it out online myself.
Okay.
Hang it in the wall.
You can let me know how it works.
Yeah. Okay. So that, again, if you have questions to send to the Image Doctors, please do so. Send us an email at talkradio@nikonians.org. And if it's interesting, we'll answer your question on the air.
And we always respond.
That's right.
You know, some questions we get don't work well for on the air topics, but we always do respond. So
that's correct.
Give us a yell.
All right, moving on to our next segment. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, guys.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So we had you've been visiting for the last week or so.
Something like that.
And you brought your camera, so we had to get out shooting.
We did.
And unfortunately, this time of year, the weather can be pretty challenging in Colorado, just depending. We've had a lot of really gloomy, snowy weather, but we did have a good day yesterday.
Yeah, we were watching the weather forecast, and it looked like in the morning might be pretty decent. So we got out there, and we didn't have a good sunrise, so we ended up...
We ditched that idea.
Yeah, we ditched that idea. Went just a little bit later in the morning after the sun was up, and it was pretty nice.
And we went to our normal stomping ground, which is the Garden of the Gods Park in Colorado Springs, because it's so easy to get to, and from where we live, it's only about a 15 to 20 minute drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the early mornings a little bit more bearable when you, if you figure you got to park and then hike somewhere to get to your spot, it all starts adding up. And even when the sunrise is coming up after 7 a.m. like it was recently, yeah, you can end up getting out there pretty early. But we went out there after the sunrise because it was pretty cloudy in the morning, and then those clouds broke out.
Yeah.
And we had some nice light, or at least good sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of our traditional overlook spot, we went and we hiked up to something called the Siamese Twins Formation, which is a pair of rock spires in the sand, red rock, and then you can
do
that fun stuff. There were some bristlecone pines in that area, and
plus, there's a nice view of Pike's Peak.
Right. And then you can do that postcard shot where there's a hole in these rocks and you can frame it through. And because we were getting pretty direct sunlight on the formation itself, you could get a nice postcard shot where you have Pike's Peak framed in the hole in the rock. So that's kind of good.
Yeah. And if you're not familiar, Pike's Peak is a mountain just outside of Colorado Springs. It's a little over 14,000 feet. So pretty good sized one.
Mm-hmm. It sort of dominates our landscape here. And it had a lot of snow on it yesterday, so it was kind of nice. So we brought a whole bunch of stuff and thought we'd go through and talk about what it was that we did there.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with something that you did, Rick, which was you brought your recently IR-converted D2X.
Right.
And you had that done at LifePixel, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, based on my experience with them, I would certainly recommend them. They seem very, very well organized. You know, when you order something from there, you prepay for the conversion. And when you do that, you get back an email that says, all right, send it to this address and all this kind of stuff. I did, and as soon as it arrives there, you get an email from them letting you know that it's arrived and that they've started working on it. And then when they complete it, which is normally in 5 to 10 days, and that's, you know, within the period it was for mine, you'll get an email back saying, we're done, and here's the tracking number for UPS, and I was very pleased at, you know, how it came back, nicely packed, clean, all that kind of good stuff. And the IR feature is really quite cool. I think I'm going to have a lot of fun with this over time. The one I got, they have three different options. There's a standard conversion that allows you to work with images that are in both color and black and white. To get them to black and white, you have to convert them, but you can do both things. And they have one that's an enhanced color option. It looked like from the images and text they had that maybe the black and white conversions weren't quite as nice, quite as punchy, or, you know, sky's quite as strong. So I skipped that one because my interests are more in the black and white realm. And then they had one that's like a deep infrared conversion that's solely black and white. And that one looked pretty cool, but I decided I wanted the option of doing some color stuff if I was interested. So I just went down the standard route. And I think that's probably a good way to go. But got out there, did some shooting with the D2X. It's interesting with the IR stuff because, you know, there are a few challenges. You know, one, if you're not familiar with it, shooting with infrared light will change your focusing point of your camera. So if you just focus normally, you'll actually end up with images that aren't that sharp.
they'll be a little bit fuzzy. And you actually have to focus slightly closer than the normal setting. So I did that. I just kind of guessed, by shifting the focusing ring a little bit and stopping down to F11, and the images turned out fine.
And you've posted some of those images already in the landscape forum mm-hmm. at Nikonians. I've mm-hmm. seen them. They're very cool.
Yeah, we'll put a link in our podcast feedback forum to those. But they do turn out quite cool. Foliage turns out, white looking. Skies can turn out quite dark, especially around here. And, it's a very different look. And I'm talking predominantly about the black and white converted ones, which is what you'll see on the site. With the initial image, it comes back looking kind of pinkish, and it varies a little bit in color depending on how you're working with the images. Raw files work the best, but you'll see a little bit of variance in the colors depending on which tool you're using. And then you can play tricks with the color ones if you want, inverting channels and making the sky go from pink to blue and all sorts of good stuff. You can definitely get that Forbidden Planet kind of landscape look, if you want. Right. I think I'm going to mainly do the black and white ones.
Well, that's neat. And we'll probably spend more time after you've had more opportunities to mess around with all the different kinds and talk about post-processing.
Oh, yeah. Because there are a bunch of little hidden issues and stuff like that. But my initial reaction is this is going to be a lot of fun. I think I'm going to have a good time with it, especially with the black and white images.
So Jessica was with us.
Yes, I was.
Three people on the shoot, and I'll put some pictures up too, and because I've got shots of all of us in various states of photographic bliss. But what you did yesterday? I mean, what was your take? I mean, we've been to Garden of the Gods before, but not to this particular spot,
right.
And usually the light hasn't been so good. I remember the last time you were out here and we went, it was really foggy all morning,
it was pretty bad.
But it was green. We had a lot of foliage, whereas this time of year it's just the evergreens. So what was fun about, what did you have fun with yesterday with that shoot?
I think the most fun was actually getting good available light and being able to play around with landscape shots and just composing pictures and the D300 that somebody kindly let me borrow.
Yeah, so
today.
So normally what are you shooting?
I normally shoot a D50, which is a great little camera.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's pretty nice and lightweight, and I have very small hands, so it's nice and comfortable for that. But the D300 was definitely a good, fun toy to play with. I have to save money now.
Did you have any issues with, the additional options or complexity? I've actually gotten a question for some people recently looking at that migration.
That's a pretty big step up going from 300.
Well, since Jason so kindly got through the menu a bit and we got some settings that I was familiar with, I think that's a good start, is to get it set up close to what you're used to doing and then playing slowly mm-hmm. as you learn the different options, learning different things you can do with it. But for the most part, I didn't have any trouble. Just figuring out the controls takes a little bit of a learning curve there.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I mean, the LCD screen is fantastic.
Yeah.
And much bigger than the D50s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's something that you really see. It really jumps out when she brought her D50 out, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, it's like I'm looking through a tiny postage stamp of it instead of that big viewfinder that I'm used to seeing. And I believe, I think I set up the camera for you to use the standard picture control mode, just standard setting, which gives you a pretty generic starting point. And I had it set up for RAW so that you can go back home with a bunch of NEFs and play with those to your heart's content and play around with them in NX or whatever you want to use. And then I think the only thing where I changed from my normal settings, the way I have it, is I put the autofocus activation back to the shutter button because that's what you're used
to
doing.
That's just what I'm used to.
The D50, you really can't decouple that. We tried, and you can do it that way, but it just doesn't work in the same way as the other cameras. So I remember going through that exercise once with you. So I put it back to the shutter button. Did you have any problems reaching the controls? Because I know we always talk about your hands are fair. You've probably got the smallest hands of any of us here in the room.
They're tiny.
And that's one of the reasons why you like the D50 so much, right?
Right. The D50 was definitely the right size, but the D300 I don't have any trouble with reaching any of the controls, just remembering where they are.
Yeah.
don't turn.
But that's down. The kind of thing you'll get used to pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah. That's not a big issue for me whatsoever. It's definitely easy to carry, easy to hold for little hands.
Now you came back and you were in LA for part of this trip here, and one of the things you were asking, you had some questions about how to get better landscape shots.
Right.
Because you go out there, and when the weather is good up in Northern Ireland, then you go to some places, and you were having some challenges just with the light, or what were the kind of issues that you were having in your pictures?
A lot of it is the light. Sometimes you get a lot of cloudy days. The sun might be out for a couple of hours. And I like going up to the Giant's Causeway on the north coast, and you don't get sunrise up there. It's down on the bottom of a cliff, and you're so far north that the sun's well south. Mm-hmm. So there's no point in trying to hit sunrise, which is good because it's a two-hour drive. Mm-hmm. But the biggest challenge I tend to have is with possible low available light is getting everything in focus for a good landscape shot.
The depth of field.
The depth of field, getting kind of the green grass in summer, wildflowers in the foreground, something, the rocky shores, and then the water and sky, trying to get everything roughly clean.
Well, here's the trick, and this is something, and I think it's a two-part, and I'll talk about it in a second when we talk about tripods, but you don't have a tripod right now.
Currently, no.
So,
but we're going to accessorize it.
we'll work on that.
My pocketbook might take a hit.
And this is probably the biggest challenge. When you're shooting a landscape and you want everything in focus, what you have to do, the only way to get it to work, is to stop down. Mm-hmm. The trade-off of stopping down is slower shutter speeds. So if you're handheld, that means the only way out of that box is to up the ISO. And so you can do that. And with a D300... shooting at something like 800 ISO is a non-issue, really. It's not a problem. But that's something to think about. If you're using a camera that doesn't have auto ISO, or you've never tried auto ISO, depending on which model the camera is, they implement it a little differently. Don't be afraid to go up to 400 or 800 if you're shooting handheld, because you do need to pay attention to that shutter speed. If you're just looking at shutter speed and you find yourself opening up the aperture to get more shutter speed, then you're not going to get the depth of field that you want in your image.
Right.
So you have to think about that.
But a tripod is
that's really the way to do it.
An essential thing to have, because it'll give you the options. You know, you can shoot at the lower ISO if you want, you know, so that you have less noise in your photo. You know, you don't have to worry so much about the shutter speed unless you have flowers that are, you know, getting bopped around because of wind. And you can stop down to, you know, whatever the photo requires. So it's a great thing to have, especially in the low light situations that you may have, you know, around sunrise and stuff. Not at the area that you were mentioning, maybe, but other places.
And if you have rocks as your subject, as we did yesterday, well, they're not going to move much. So a slow shutter speed doesn't really matter at all.
Yeah.
I've never seen a rock run.
No. But, you know, in that overcast light that you were talking about, one of the things that, you know, we've talked about in the past that works well is maybe don't go for the overall landscape kind of shot, because it just doesn't necessarily work well in that light. Go for tighter compositions, you know, a section that's maybe, you know, only about 10 feet away from you, include some nice logs or rocks and flowers and things like that, or even getting closer, you know, doing some macro stuff. And again, a tripod will help, because otherwise your arms just get tired of holding up that camera and you stop shooting. You know, a lot sooner than you would otherwise.
Definitely.
Now, speaking of tripods, you were lucky enough to come out and visit, so we loaned you one yesterday.
Yes, mm-hmm. You did.
And I forget which tripod you were using, because it was Rick's. Which
It's a Gitzo 1227.
1227.
Mm-hmm. It's not made anymore.
But. Right. That was it's the three-section carbon fiber, and it's been replaced by the 2200 series or something like that, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I think like a 2530, I think. Is
something like that. Yeah. But they're comparable. And then you had the Markins Q3 Emil ball head.
Right.
So how did that work for you?
That was fantastic. It definitely allows you to get all sorts of stuff that I'm not used to being able to sit there and play around with, because I have to hand hold most of the time.
And that ball head is so small and yet so sturdy that it holds the D300 with no trouble at all.
Yeah, I've like when we talked about it in the past, I've had my D3 and 300 F4 on it and not an issue. It's a good one.
Yeah, nice and secure, but lightweight. I could carry it around with everything and not feel off balance.
So what kind of lenses were you playing with yesterday?
Oh, yesterday I had my 18 to 70 for most of the landscape shots. Mm-hmm. And what did I borrow from you?
Oh, the Sigma 10 to 20?
Yeah, I got some of that. That was fun to play with.
Definitely. That's a whole different perspective.
Definitely,
literally.
Yeah. You move the camera around a little bit and you almost get dizzy on the, watching the edges too much. But I love my 18 to 70 for landscapes and stuff. It's just
that's a very nice lens.
It's handy. It's perfect for almost anything. And it's what I grab when I want minimum stuff.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at some of your images that we downloaded into the computer this morning, and they were clean corner to corner.
Oh yeah,
being stopped down at f/11, that was it looked just as good as anything else.
Yeah, we've recommended that lens, you know, quite a few times. It's just very nice, light, compact, and it's sharp.
Yeah, it's I have one, and it's nice to put a little lens on and go around and walk around. If you've got good light, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Was there anything else that you ran into? Was there anything you ran into yesterday that was a challenge, or you wish you could have done better, or have questions?
Oh, well, that Garden of the Gods, I was just playing mostly. A lot of it is going to come when I go back and look at the pictures. Then I'll learn more.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, most of it is just getting the right depth of field, getting the focus set right for those big shots.
All right. Now, how about you, Jason? What were you playing with?
And doing? I went pretty simple. I brought... Mm-hmm. It was amazing how light my bag seemed.
Yeah.
So I packed my Airport Antidote, which is my favorite small backpack right now, especially if I'm not doing any serious hiking. It's quite a nice little bag. But I had my D3, and then I had the I had a 24 to 70. I had a 14 to 24 and the 70 to 200 VR.
Now, you were having some fun with that 14 to 24, as I saw.
That is a fun lens.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculously wide that you can do stuff. Because we had at Garden of the Gods, when you're in the rock formations, they deliver very prominent foreground objects. And anytime you're using a lens that wide, I mean, 14 millimeters is freakishly wide.
On a D3.
On a D3. So you really need to have foreground objects up close. So I was doing some stuff where I was getting on the ground. There were some old, some yuccas growing there that they weren't brown, but they weren't really green either. They were kind of in between. It's still that time of year, and trying to get everything in focus, shooting at F16. And other things that the 14 to 24 does really well is it makes skies just look spectacular. So I was getting less foreground and pulling in more of the sky, and with the matrix metering, they turn that deep blue.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the fortune of having some wispy clouds yesterday. We don't always get good clouds in Colorado Springs. It's either really cloudy or really clear and not in between. And so I was looking at some of the shots and just get those deep blue skies that are just ridiculously nice to look at. I did mostly use the 24 to 70.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic focal length range. I really like that a lot. You can do a lot of stuff with it. I did the postcard shot of putting Pike's Peak in the middle of the hole at the Siamese Twins formation, but a lot of things like that. And that lens, if I had only brought the 24 to 70, I would have been perfectly happy there. I could have gone with one lens. Didn't really need the other stuff, but it was fun. And then there were some bristlecone pines, and there was some frost on the sort of gnarly looking logs. The twisted root system, and that's fun with the super wide lens to do that. So that's kind of what I was just messing with. And I was on the tripod for a while and then off the tripod. One of the things when using a really wide lens is that it's unlikely to get camera shake until you get really slow exposure. So I just bumped the ISO up a little bit on the D3. I think it was sitting around, it didn't really go much over 400 with the kind of light we had yesterday. I've dialed in a custom setting for my landscape shots where I figure I'm usually using a wide lens. I think it tries to cap the shutter speed at no less than 1/125th of a second. Because I figure with a wide angle lens, that's usually plenty for sharp images. And then it doesn't kick the ISO up too high. Not that I couldn't have shot it higher, but why push it, right? Yeah. And so far from the images I've seen, other than a couple of dust spots, which I can get rid of, they're great.
The D3 does collect dust.
It does.
Yeah.
So that's a camera that if you have a blower, like a rocket blower, which I think you just bought, Jessica.
Yes, I finally did get one.
And that's something you'll want to do before and after every shot. It's just blow that dust
shoot.
Out.
Shoot. Right.
Yeah, every shoot. Sorry. Yeah, not every shot. That would be a little bit anal retentive, and even more so than we use. It's one thing to obsess about dust. It's another thing to take to clean your sensor after every shot. But before you go out on a shoot like that, it's a good thing to blow your sensor off. That's a trick.
Now, the one other thing I was playing around with, I almost had too many different things I was trying to do on this shoot, which is usually a mistake. But
Your bag was heavier than mine.
Yeah, it was kind of big. But the other thing I was doing was using the new 24mm tilt-shift lens with the D3, just so we could talk about
it. And you just got that one recently.
Yeah, not too
long. It just only started shipping recently.
Yeah, I've just had it for about a week or so. So I haven't had a lot of chances to use it. I've definitely put it through its paces, you know, including this shoot. And, you know, at least so far, I'm very pleased with that. I think I'm going to have a blast with it, too, because it's something I've been looking for quite a while.
Now, you were saying something about how you liked using this one a lot more than your 85, the older PC lens.
Well, it's...
In terms of operation.
Yeah, it's more convenient. You know, if you're using it on a D3 or a D300... It functions pretty similarly to, you know, a regular lens. In other words, you don't have to worry about stopping the diaphragm down, you know, for metering and for actual shooting like you do with the 85. You can use it more or less like a normal lens, and, you know, it'll meter correctly. You know, typical open aperture metering. You do have to do that before you shift it or tilt it, otherwise you'll get incorrect exposures.
So you lock the exposure.
I use manual exposure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So once you've locked that in and manual exposure mode, the easiest way to lock an exposure.
Yeah, and then you shift it or tilt it, because it will make a significant difference, you know, like more than a stop.
Now, for our listeners who are not familiar with the stop-down metering on these mm-hmm. older PC lenses, what is that?
Well, it means that, you know, if you've ever played with your depth of field preview button, mm-hmm. where you press it and then the image gets darker in the viewfinder because it's stopped down to the actual aperture. You know, the diaphragm gets little and closes down. You actually have to meter it like that.
So you stop it down physically, mm-hmm. it meters, and then you lock that exposure in, and then you have to physically stop down the aperture before you shoot.
Right.
Because in this particular case, what happens is that the camera won't stop the lens down for you. There's no coupling.
Right. On the older
85. The older lenses.
Yeah. But on this one, you don't have to worry about that, so it's very easy to use.
At least with the D3.
And it's got a little button on the lens itself that you can use for that depth of field preview.
So if you're using this on a body earlier than the D3 or D300, you'll still have to do the old style mm-hmm. of metering and stop down. Mm-hmm. With the new cameras, it has this electronically controlled diaphragm so that the camera can tell it how far it's stopped down. Yeah, that's
but there aren't
neat.
Many
that's
camera handy. Bodies that support it.
Yeah. That's a very new feature. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what I was playing with on it, and you can go back to that episode where we talked about tilt-shift lenses for their general features, but I did a combination of things where I was tilting the lens to get increased depth of field, you know, foreground objects and distant objects in sharp focus worked well for that. And then I also used the shift feature to shoot some panos. And that's kind of fun, too, because you put the camera in just one spot, and then you shift it to the left, shift it to the right, and then you've got two images that encompass a fairly wide area. And then I just used the photo merge feature in Photoshop CS3 to automatically join them. Worked great. You know, very, very simple and kind of fun. And it gives me an image that looks a lot like the ones from my X-Pan camera that we've talked about in the past nice. That does panos. So did both of those kind of things.
So it's like the poor man's large format camera.
Yeah, yeah. Great for landscape stuff. So, again, I'm looking forward to doing some more shooting with that. I'm going to go out to the Moab area, Canyonlands and Arches, and probably use that here in a few weeks.
Well, then we'll be looking forward to seeing some of those shots.
The images are very sharp and contrasty. No complaints there. The only thing I would say that I wish was a little bit different is when you tilt the lens, the it's kind of like you release a control to enable that, and then there's not any dampening or whatever, really. It just kind of goes. I don't know how to I'm not describing that
well. It's kind of get floppy.
It gets a little bit floppy, and it would be good if there were a more intermediate position where it didn't just like kind of flop. Yeah, exactly. A tension knob like you'd find on the ball head. That isn't as good as it should be, in my opinion. Not a big deal, and I certainly wouldn't, you know, avoid buying the lens because of that, but you know, just something I think they could have done a little bit better. That's about it in terms of complaints, though.
Let's see. I had a few other things written down here. You were using a new Stingray filter that you got?
Oh, I've had it a while.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had it a while. It's a thing called a color combo LB filter, and it's a combination of several things. It's a polarizer. It has a little bit of warmth added to it, which helps counteract the normal coolness that you see from polarizers. Uh-huh. And then it's got a color intensifier thing too, so which really brings out the red. Yeah, it's a triple whammy, and it's quite a nice filter. It's not cheap, but it does some good stuff, and it's tasteful. It's not over the top, and for the images that I was making out there at Garden of the Gods, where we have those red sandstone rocks, mm-hmm. a lot of times they just turn out too orangish. And so what this does is just shift the color a little bit in the red direction, just about the way that you actually remembered the things, and then darkens up the sky just a touch, you know, with the polarizer effect. And if you're shooting at the same white balance setting for the whole thing, which I was just using a daylight preset white balance, uh-huh. you'll find that the images with and without the filter look about the same in terms of white balance, which means it's again counteracting that coolness that you see with a polarizer. And so it's very nice.
Good.
Especially for film users, I think it's great because you don't have as many facilities to, you know, change the color balance and all those things. But it's nice with digital too.
Okay. So anybody else have any thoughts on this topic before we move on?
No.
Okay.
Beat that one to death.
I think so. Well, I mean, it is a fun place to go. I never get tired of going to the Garden of the Gods. And if you work it, it's one of those places that you can spend time. It's kind of what we talked about. If you have something that's your local area, go and get the traditional shot. And then, hey, since you live there, go back and do the non-traditional stuff. Mm-hmm. Work an area, play around with things, do stuff that isn't just what everybody would expect to see from there.
Right.
And fill up your portfolio that way. Well, later on in the day, Jessica and I drove up to Denver, about an hour from here, to the Botanic Gardens in Denver. And this time of year, most of the Botanic Gardens is outdoors, so it's still brown and kind of dead looking, so we didn't go walk around the grounds. What we did do is we went inside to the tropical greenhouse area, and we played around a little bit with macro.
We did.
And so we wanted to talk a little bit about that, and because Jessica, you don't have a macro lens proper.
No,
so,
I don't.
So what were you doing? Well, set you up with kind of the poor man's macro.
Right.
Kit,
right? So I have my 70-300 VR.
Okay.
That and then we put a little extension tube on it.
And this is one of those Kenko autofocus tubes.
Right.
So it has the electric contacts and a set of the three tubes. I don't know how much they'll run you, but they're not expensive.
About $170 in the U.S. Okay. at the moment. Yeah.
And you can find these things used, too. I mean, I bought mine used, and that, you know, as long as they're in decent shape and the electrical contacts work.
There's not a lot to go wrong.
No, and in fact, they support autofocus, AFS, and VR.
Right.
Yeah. VR unfortunately, Nikon doesn't make any right now. The only thing you can get from Nikon, if they still have them, I haven't checked.
Which is the manual
tubes. Old tubes that were intended to be used with manual focus lenses. So I've got some of those in my closet. I need to get the Kenko ones.
Yeah, it's. I wish they were a little bit more robust in their construction, but they work fine.
Yeah.
And we use the 20 millimeter tube, which is sort of the mid-sized one. And with the 70-300, it has a minimum focus distance of about five feet.
I think,
so not quite 2 meters. with adding the 20 millimeters extension, which isn't much, you can knock that down to about a meter and a half, mm-hmm. or a little less than that. So it's somewhere in the four. You shave about a foot and a half, I'd say, off of the minimum focus distance. Yeah. And at 300 millimeters, that gives you, that's a very good working distance. I don't know what the actual magnification ratio is, but that's close enough for most small wildlife subjects like lizards and fairly large insects and stuff like that.
If they sit still. Yeah.
Good for flowers, too.
Flowers sit still.
So yeah. We were mostly looking for flowers, right?
Right, yeah. Typically what they had.
And so you still had the tripod.
Right.
The 1227. Which
was definitely a godsend.
Well, and one of the reasons you needed the tripod was because you were doing available light macro.
Right.
And with macro, the closer you get, the depth of field gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
And you really start to see, you know, the effects of shaking hands and things like that.
Right. So you didn't have a cable release.
No, I did not.
Because I was using mine.
Yeah, I couldn't borrow
Since
it.
Since you were borrowing my D300, it was kind of hard to share the cable right. release. So we did another trick.
Right. We did.
And so that was where we went in the menus, right?
Yeah.
And we found custom setting D9.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you tell us what that one does, Jess?
Well, that one basically is kind of a shutter release delay. So you hit the button, and then it takes a little bit of a time so you don't get the wiggle from pushing the button on the camera.
Flips up the mirror and then releases the shutter.
Yeah. There's a little lag, and that's usually good enough to dampen most vibrations
right.
for a subject like that.
Now, did you guys do the trick of the self-timer and setting it to 2 seconds also?
We didn't do that, but that's the other thing you can do is that on top of that, then set the self-timer, so you add in an additional right. two-second delay.
Yeah, the nice thing about that is it isn't a really long delay, so you're not sitting around there for a long time, but it removes the issue of your finger, you know, pressing on the shutter release, mm-hmm. inducing vibration.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's another trick you can do. Mm-hmm. And then you're using the same tripod and ball head, which is pretty much mandatory if you're going to do that kind of shooting.
Right.
And so what did you think of that? What were the challenges that you had, or what was your experience?
Some of the challenges are just getting used to doing macro and knowing, you know, what settings to put on the camera. You know, you have to play with it and change it wildly from just running around doing landscape shots. And, you know, you want to be able to focus in close up. And that was the big challenge. You're 3 feet from this nice big flower and you just can't get a focus set. So you helped me out a bit.
And manual focus helps a lot with the macro. A lot of times the autofocus, especially if it's something like a flower where it doesn't have a lot of contrast, there's no well-defined edges. It just, you see a red flower or a yellow flower or whatever. Mm-hmm. Picking where to focus on can be really tricky. So manual helps out a lot.
Right.
And that's where something like an AFS lens can be very useful. The other thing that I find with using a zoom for macro is that that's really handy. Because the reproduction ratio changes a little bit when the focal length changes. So you can use the zoom to actually focus. You can, if you're set a certain distance and then you change the zoom, it will focus
on
the subject.
Yeah, I did find that.
And you can use it to frame the subject, which is nice as well. So it's just an extra degree of freedom that I found when shooting that way.
Yeah, because the problem is if you're using a fixed focal length lens, what happens, you find yourself just shifting your tripod around all the time.
And that can be a real challenge.
Yeah, it's, you know, in order to get the right framing and stuff. So a zoom lens is really handy for macro. And I think at some point in the past, we talked about the old 70 to 180 macro, which is a really great one for that kind of thing. But a lot more expensive. Using the 70-300 with an extension tube is a great alternative.
Right, and from the images I saw, it worked really well.
Mm-hmm. Now, be sure to switch off the VR if you're using it on a tripod.
That's right.
You don't need that.
Right, it'll screw up your photos even. Yeah.
So you had that, and now I was using a little different setup because I do have the 105 VR macro lens, and I decided I would play around with my R1 C1 a little bit. I still had a tripod. Whole
now,
thing.
You got to talk a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, the R1 C1 is the remote macro flash speedlight kit that came out a couple of years ago. I think it came out the same time the D200 was announced. And we've talked about using them a little bit in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We're still going to go up to the Butterfly Pavilion again and play with it. And you get a very different look. Well, the R1C1 is three components, essentially. There's two ring-mounted mini speed lights, very small, and you can adjust the angle at which they mount onto the... It comes on a ring, and the ring has adapters for different filter thread size. So I use the 62-millimeter adapter. There's this big plastic ring, and you can actually rotate these two speed lights around the ring, which is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. You lock them into place. They clip in, so they're not going to fall off. And then there's a infrared commander module that goes in your hot shoe. So there's unlike the old speed light, ring light designs where you had these cables coming across. And I tell you, I hated that stuff because it always gets in the way with your lens operation. It gets in the way of your hands and you're trying to focus on things, and it can be a real pain. So this is kind of elegant. And it's very easy to use handheld, although I was still using a tripod for most of the shots. The trickiest thing with macro is that when you get in really close, if your subject to camera distance changes in the least, things go in and out of the plane of focus right. Very quickly. So a tripod is almost essential there for that. The thing about using a ring light is it gives you a completely different look. It's a very different kind of look than what you get with doing available light macros. And depending on what your subject is, you either like that look or you don't. It just depends. With the flash, when you use the R1C1, the commander module, you get TTL flash, but you don't get it balanced fill flash mode. And you can effectively get balanced fill flash mode by looking at your light meter, and if you're shooting a manual, and open up and set the settings. But a lot of time with macro, you're shooting down around F11, F16. And a lot of times then you're never going to get enough light without a very slow shutter speed. So why would you want to use a flash? You'd use the flash because you're taking a picture of something that's moving. Insects are a good example, or something that's so close that when you get closer and closer to the subject, you're actually casting a shadow on it, and there's really no available light anyway.
Yeah.
But you get a very different look. Jessica's shots, we were looking at those, and they have very nice out-of-focus green backgrounds from all the foliage, whereas when you use the flash, you get very sharp detail, excellent depth of field, and very sharp detail on the subject, but the background goes almost pitch black very quickly.
Yeah.
So you get those stark. Now, that can be very good creative. I've seen a lot of flower images in National Geographic where that's the effect that they're looking for, where you're trying to do that. Other times, that sort of pleasant, out-of-focus, nice green or otherwise colored background, you really need to do that in a by using available light. So it's two different ways of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one is better.
No, but there is a hybrid that you were kind of hitting at, which is you use a flash, but then you set your exposure manually so that the background is, you know, correctly exposed, and you'll get a fairly natural look, but the flash will just bring out a little bit more color and contrast in your primary subject. And that can be a nice way to go, too. So you've got a whole variety of options.
Yeah, it does get a little trickier. And I was playing with the D3, cranking up the ISO to something like 2000 to help me get more of that background light. That's something I couldn't do before with the D2X. I really couldn't crank the ISO up nearly as high.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps.
I think one thing that's worth pointing out, too, with that R1C1 is, like you were saying, it's a couple little miniature flash units. It's not a ring light, because you can also find, older ones where the flash tube was actually a ring shape
right.
that went around the lens. And those are used a lot of times by dentists and stuff like that. You'll get the very even shadowless kind of lighting. That's not what this one does. It you can do some things that start looking a little bit like a ring light, but it really is a couple separate flash units, and you can vary the exposure for them between the different units. So you could have one that was brighter and one that was just doing fill flash. Do some creative things.
The R1C1 has two modes, and the way you switch between the modes is it's a little hidden switch.
Mm-hmm.
And the switch lives underneath the battery compartment door of this thing for reasons I don't understand.
I don't
either. There's a little toggle switch in there. It's a little white switch, a little dip switch actually. And it has the traditional icon for macro is that tulip.
Mm-hmm.
The flower, right?
Flower.
And then they have another icon that I don't remember what the other icon is, but it's the other. There's only a two-position switch, so it's the other position, right? In macro mode, the R1C1 assumes that you're just using one bank of speed lights. And the if you've heard our shows on the wireless flash, the wireless TTL, the commander modules will can control three separate banks, group A, B, and C of flashes. And you can set the groupings differently on the R1C1. But if you just have one group, what it assumes is that you have two flashes, flash A and B. And then by default, it gives you a one-to-one ratio of the two flashes. So it puts equal amounts of light out both. And so if you've got them more or less, if you arrange the flashes to be on opposite poles of the ring, mm-hmm. so they're kind of 180 degrees angle between mm-hmm. the two, then you're going to get more or less even lighting. But then what you can do is just dial in the ratio. So you can go 1.5 to 1 mm-hmm. or 2 to 1, 3 to... And so you can start turning up one light and then allow... And this is nice because it allows you, for some subjects, to get that texture. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example.
It's like what you do with a portrait of a person, right?
Right. Or I'll give you an example. Let's say you're shooting a coin. Mm-hmm. Something that has relief on it. There was a great thread in the macro section on coins and the Nikonians. There were some really cool shots. And something that has relief, whether it's raised or recessed, you need to get shadows in there
right.
in order to see it. If you take a picture of a regular coin straight on with a single flash, it's not going to look very good. It's going to look flat. You won't see that relief. If you use two flashes or one flash at an angle, you start casting shadows into the relief on the coin. It makes a huge difference in what you get. Mm-hmm. So the R1C1 unit allows you to do that very easily, either between groups of banks of flashes or just within a single bank, adjusting the output between the two flashes. So that's really, and I just had mine both were set at group A, and then I could just toggle them a little bit back and forth mm-hmm. to get some different look.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that flash in a future episode when we get back up to the butterfly place.
But where
I just haven't used mine right. enough.
Where that flash really works well is when you're trying to freeze the action on potentially moving subjects mm-hmm. or you're very, very close to them. Mm-hmm. If you've got flowers and stuff in an indoor place, and that's the other thing. I mean, a lot of times you're outside and there's wind moving around, and that's mm-hmm. a real pain in the butt for macro. So indoors, like we were yesterday,
wind was not
unless you were right next to the air conditioner, and there were a few places where the ventilation shaft where there was some wind. But then you can do, so what if it's a tenth of a second, and yeah. you can get really nice looking shots that way.
All right. Anything else on that, or should we move on to the prescription?
Just if Jessica has any more questions for getting better macro shots.
You can't have too many questions without a lot of experience, so I definitely need to go out more and practice. I'm sure I'll grow more questions as I get out and play. Mm-hmm. I don't have any off the top of my head, but I think not being afraid to change your ISO is that good one. Mm-hmm. And getting there and playing with the settings of things you might not look at to make sure you get a good picture.
Yeah, I guess yesterday I came back. We were walking around independently, and I hear this, not enough light, not enough light. And I said, Jessica, you're thinking like you're shooting handheld again.
Right.
You got plenty of light. You're on a tripod. Just let's do this, and it's okay.
Yeah.
And get it, and I'll tell you, that's one of those things. When you're not used to using a tripod, you have to remind yourself that, okay, it's a half second exposure.
So what?
And that's
big deal.
Okay.
Yeah, it was okay. So doing that, and I guess the bigger point, part of the reason why we went up to check out this place was something that you brought up before we started recording today, mm-hmm. and that is places like this, the indoor botanical gardens, are good places to go in the middle of winter when it's too cold to be outside, or you don't want to be outside, or more important, the light is crummy. Mm-hmm. Hey, being in a greenhouse, so what if it's overcast outside?
Bring a short sleeve t-shirt.
Yeah. And it's also a controlled environment, too. If you're wanting to learn more about macro and macro lighting, it's kind of painless to do it there because you don't have wind around. The light isn't changing constantly. And it's just a great learning environment.
The one thing I would recommend to be careful about is going at peak times.
Yeah, don't
because these places tend to be really tight and very small paths, narrow paths that people walk around on. And so if you've got a tripod, assuming they even let you bring one in, I mean, if you have one, just be courteous to others there and be aware that
because
you're carrying around a lot of stuff and you can easily bump into people.
But, you know, maybe go there on a weekday morning right when they open or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When the school trips aren't there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right.
Prescription.
It's time for our prescription, and this is one that came I see it all the time when I'm on vacation because I can't help it. I notice people with Nikon cameras. Actually, I notice people with DSLRs, but seen a lot of Nikons lately, and I see a lot of folks wandering around not using their lens hood. And if there's one really easy thing you can do to improve pictures, outdoors especially, is to use that lens hood that came with your camera lens.
Right. It'll cut out the stray light that could cause lens flare. It's also a good protective
thing. Absolutely.
It's much better than a UV filter or something like that, because UV filters won't do what we just discussed with, you know, cutting out the stray light. But it will give your lens some protection against bumping around. And if you want to leave your lens cap off for a while, it'll support that.
Well, I would say even more so with using something like a UV filter. Putting a filter on the lens increases the chance for flare if you have light. So if you're going to have a filter, put that lens hood on.
Yeah.
And the only time it's really a problem is when you're using a polarizer, when you need to get and access that filter and turn it. It can be kind of awkward to use. And the other tip, and this is something that when we had Renzo in the studio, he brought up.
Yeah, we will have Renzo back, by the way.
We will.
We just got to get that scheduled.
We need to get him to not work so much.
Mm-hmm.
He's always working on weekends. The lens hoods for the most of the newer Nikon lenses, in the last 5 years, are the bayonet type mount. So you click it in and just turn it a half turn and they lock in. What a lot of people don't realize is that you can stow that lens hood on the lens and mount it in reverse.
Right. And bayonets on in the same way.
Exactly. Right. It just goes on. You just turn it around. And that's incredibly useful for when you're packing it. I know a lot of people don't want to bring their lens hood because it's like, oh, gee, it makes my lens too tall. Well, just turn it around, reverse, click it in there.
That's where mine live.
And then you can pack it on there. And it's something that's not obvious because they don't come mounted on the lens when you buy the lens. It comes in that little box. And the lens hood's in a separate little box inside the magic gold box. So that's a trick. And so you don't always have to have the lens hood deployed in its normal position when you're stowing your stuff. But it does provide a tremendous amount of protection to your lens.
Yeah.
Because you figure it's going to bump into anything first.
Yeah, and it's like a little plastic shock absorber.
Right.
Very good. Okay.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. We'll see you again in another 2 weeks.
Yep. And as we always remind people, vote for us on Podcast Alley. You can just do a search for Nikonians Talk Radio on there. And as usual, we'll have a link to it in our podcast blog webpage.
Okay. We'll see you next time then.
Yeah, in 2 weeks. Thanks.